topic tonight
is power. I want to talk to you about power. Now, the dictionary that sits on my desk has 12 different definitions of power. Everything from electricity to an algebraic expression. But the kind of power I want to talk to you about tonight has nothing to do with physics or mathematics. It's in the realm of human effort and human relationships, human affairs, and social conduct. It is specifically the power to alter governments and the power to create the kind of a world in which our children will live. Now, in 1877, there was a French playwright and author by the name of Victor Hugo. You've heard his name. He's written a lot of books, but about the only one that we Americans know is The Hunchback of Notre Dame. But he has written a lot of other books and plays. And most of them we haven't read, not even in France. But in 1877, he published one book called History of a Crime. And there's one sentence from that book that has been translated into almost every language in the world, at least every major language in the world. And you've all heard it in one form or another. And the thought expressed in that sentence is this: greater than the force of mighty armies is the power of an idea whose time has come. Now that is the kind of power that I want to discuss with you today. The purpose of my presentation is to advocate an idea whose hour, whose time has come. An idea that, if given sufficient energy and sufficient exposure, is so powerful that all of the totalitarians in the world, with their armies and their agencies of coercion, cannot stand against it. Now, I have great misgivings about this presentation here this evening because, in reality, it is merely one, designed to be one, of five parts. This is just the fifth part. And the larger presentation is called The Future is Calling. And maybe some of you have been to the Freedom Force website and you've had a chance to read the first four parts, which have already been delivered. They've been pretty well polished, and there they are. And many people for months have been saying, where's part five? This is part five. But it's dangerous to jump to part five and skip over part one through four. It's like walking into a play and seeing the final scene, the final act in the play, and not knowing what went on in the first four acts. It can get to be pretty confusing. So I have misgivings about that, because I'm going to be talking tonight about solutions to a problem. Now, I'm just talking about solutions. And unless we're all on the same page as to what the problem is, it's kind of dangerous, because you may think that this is not the solution to the problem at all. So I have to at least allude to the problem in a very cursory fashion. As I see the problem condensed, all those first four parts, down into three little summary statements, it would be this. One of the problems is the growth of government and the loss of personal freedom. Now that covered a lot of territory, doesn't it? And you can think of all kinds of examples of that problem. Another category is corruption in government and hidden agendas. Boy, you could talk for days and days on that, couldn't you? And the third area, though, is something that many people may not have thought about, and that is the fact that almost all of the problems in those first two categories are based on an ideology, a motivation that drives the men who are perpetuating these events, that drives them forward to do them. And there is a temptation on our part to look at these people who are taking away our freedoms, or who are undergoing hidden agendas, or following hidden agendas, and we think that, well, they're bad people. They're bad. They're evil. They're trying to do something bad to us. and to society and to the future. And I need to tell you that when you analyze, at least as I analyze it, that is not necessarily true. Most of these people actually do not think of themselves as evil at all. They have their own agenda, their own ideology, their own concept for a better world, which they think they are implementing. And if necessary, they have to fool us and trick us into going along with it because we are too stupid to understand the wisdom of their master strategy. But they really think that they are doing good. And it's important that we understand that. It's important to know what that ideology is that they hold in the back of their mind, because that is the motive for the crime, or at least what we call the crime. But it's the motive for the act, and they don't see it as a crime at all. So what is this ideology? I've devoted almost all of part one of this five-part series to that issue alone. It's called The Chasm. And it is devoted to the concept that most of the thinking people who even concern themselves with these issues in the Western world are divided by a chasm of thought. There are only two positions in the thinking process. It's not an issue of right versus left, or liberal versus conservative, or communist versus capitalist, or fascists, or Nazis, or all of these words that people throw around. Now we have neoconservative, whatever that means. People use these words and they think for a fleeting moment that they've defined something. And they have defined absolutely nothing. Because they have no meaning that on which everyone can agree. And no wonder we're all arguing with each other, because we're using words which have different meanings to us both. And I found that once we get rid of the labels and look at the substance of the principles underneath, it's amazing how people who thought they were on opposite sides of an issue actually are in total agreement. And I'm sure that our enemies like that kind of division and confusion that arise from the use of these words that have no meaning. There is a chasm that divides people between only two possible positions. Only two. And they are collectivism on the one side and individualism on the other. Now, that's not our mission tonight. We don't have time to go into all of the ramifications of what those words mean, but I'll give you just a hint. The basic philosophy underneath collectivism, and there are several of them, but the basic one is this. The group is more important than the individual. And the individual or the minority must be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. Now that is the underlying justification that drives these people to do all of the things they do. They can say, well, it's too bad that we have to sacrifice a few people here and there, but it's for the greater good of the greater number. It's for the greater good of society. It's for the greater good of the world. And once you have that awful concept in your mind as being legitimate, and it's easy to buy that, I'm telling you that when I went through school, I accepted that. And it has a certain appeal to it. After all, Does it make sense that the majority should rule? The majority? Shouldn't they determine what the minority does? Once you get that concept in your mind and you think that that is good, then there is absolutely nothing that you cannot perpetrate on mankind in the name of the greater good of society. Absolutely nothing. I mean, it doesn't make any difference if you were President Wilson and you were watching the Lusitania sail into submarine-infested waters in World War I, knowing that the risk of it being sunk was very, very high, and doing absolutely nothing to protect it because you knew that there were several hundred Americans on board, and you knew that if the ship were sunk by the Germans, that this would raise the anger of the American people, and they would be more apt to justify and support a war, getting America into a war to save the world for democracy. A few hundred American lives is tragic, but look at the greater good, to save the world for democracy, or whatever. You could be a President Roosevelt, knowing that the Japanese armada was steaming directly toward Pearl Harbor, knowing the exact moment that the ships left the Japanese docks. The radio signals would come in, okay, the ships are now moving, they're coming on this particular area through the ocean, and you would order all of the naval ships out of the area, all the commercial ships out of the area, so that nobody could see the Japanese armada on its way. If anybody were to see them, they might get on the radio and say, something's going on here. And you would justify that. You would pretend like you didn't know this was happening when you knew the exact day of the attack, even the exact hour of the attack, so that there would be several thousand Americans to lose their lives. And this would raise the ire of the American people and justify getting into this World War II to put an end to Nazism and fascism. And look what a great thing that was. The greater good at the greater number. You could be in this modern age knowing that there were terrorists planning to use airplanes to crash into office buildings or government buildings, knowing for months, if not years, that this was the plan. You could have intercepted messages knowing the month, and then finally the week, and then finally the day of the attack, and pretend not to know anything at all about it, so that when it happens, again, we could be the victim. It's too bad about those several thousand Americans, but you know, look at the greater good that came out of that. Now we have the Americans solidly behind this war on terrorism. Now we can go into the Middle East and become a dominant world force and make it a better world. We can build a new world order based on the model of collectivism. And that certainly is the best possible vision for the future you could have if you were a collectivist. There is nothing that you cannot justify. The greatest atrocity that you can think of could be justified once you hold in your mind this horrible concept, the basis of collectivism, that the individual or the minority can be sacrificed for the greater good of a greater number. It's important for us to understand that aspect of the problem if we're going to have an intelligent solution to it. Not only do we have to understand what collectivism is, not only do we have to understand that this motivates these people, but we better jolly well have a constructive opposite to it, something equal or better and opposite to the philosophy of collectivism, which is individualism. If you're curious about that, and I sure hope you are, I urge you to come on to our website and read The Chasm. All right, that's kind of an overview. That's the first four parts, all condensed down into a couple of minutes. And you didn't do a very good job of it, but at least you know how I look at the problem. What my mindset is, as we now proceed to the solution to the problem. And to do that, I'd like to start off with my two-minute seminar on apathy. That's three. You thought you were just getting, a presentation on a solution. No, this is apathy seminar time. I remember when I first became aware of some of these issues way back in the 60s. I was reading all these books and becoming alarmed, and I'd go around to my friends and say, I'd practically grab them by the lapels and say, no, listen to this, did you know this? And of course, they were backing away, and I was getting glazed. Oh, you didn't say that? Yeah, I ruined a lot of parties. But I couldn't understand at the time how these people could be so apathetic. Here, I'm all charged up, I'm ready to save the world, and they're looking at me like, who are you talking about? And all they seemed to be interested in was their golf game, or they wanted to go back to television, or whatever. And I remember thinking that people are so apathetic. And then one day I had this great epiphany. I realized that I was the problem, not them. And what made me realize that is this analogy. If you picture yourself in a life raft, a rubber life raft in the middle of the ocean, and you're all alone, you look over the edge, and here are some little bubbles coming up over the edge, and you realize, uh-oh, my raft has a leak. What do? Well, your raft has a leak. You just lie there and sink. You are the picture of apathy. But now, let's change the scenario. You look around the raft and, oh, now you see an air pump and a place to screw it in. Now what do? You screw it in and you're pumping away. And you'll be pumping that air pump for days and days and days, for as long as you have any energy left. Now you're an activist. And the only difference between those two scenarios is that in the first case, it was hopeless. And in the second case, there was something, at least something, to do. I thought, oh my gosh, I did such a good job of telling these people how bad things were that I convinced them that it was hopeless. I had created the apathy in their minds. And so naturally, they didn't want to get any further into it. If you can't do anything about a problem, you just lie there and sink. So I realized, well, boy, I better change my tactics here. I decided that from that point forward, I would never discuss problems unless I also had a solution to the problem of some kind. Well, that was easier said than done. Solutions, you can say, write your congressman, spread the word, become informed, all those things. And that was my solution. But I always came up with a solution. And it made me feel good, made them feel good. But deep down underneath, I had this thought that, this isn't going to work. I could see the rising tide coming on all these years, and my solution wasn't going to work. But I wouldn't let on. I wouldn't let anybody know. Because after all, if you blow a trumpet very weakly, nobody's going to follow you in battle. So you've got to sound good when you blow that trumpet. Well, the doodle. So I always put on a good show and a happy face and think, well, we're going to do it. If we do this and if we are strong and if we have resolve, we're going to do it. But deep in my heart, my whole brother, this is really rough. And I kind of thought that there would be a miracle. Miracles have happened in history. The American Revolution was one, as you know. It stood no chance at all of winning that war against the greatest military might. And I remember the Battle of Trent, reading about it. I wasn't there, folks. But reading about it was the most amazing little piece of history. You realize that a week before that battle, when Washington crossed the Delaware with a surprise attack on the British encampment, or the Hessian encampment in Trent, the week before that, there was a major battle between the two forces, and Washington's force was, I think it was about 40% of his men were killed. 40%. And what remained of his forces were demoralized, they were out of ammunition, they had very little food, they didn't even have wood to burn in the cold winter snow, their tents were all tattered, their shoes were worn out, they had rags on their feet, place of shoes. Not only that, the enlistments for these men were up on January 1st, and this was a week later. These men were packing up, getting ready to go home. The war was over. The revolutionary forces were defeated. There was no way in the world that they could win that war. So Washington thought it over, and he says, I got an idea. Let's attack. And his generals looked at him and said, George, you've got to be crazy. What do you mean attack? We're defeated. He says, no, we're not. Not if we attack. They think we're defeated. But if we attack, they won't expect it. And he was wrong. The rest of the story. He got his men together and he asked them, as a point of honor, Would you extend your enlistment and follow me into one more battle? I don't expect you to do it, he said, but I ask you to do it. To a man, they said yes. So, in the middle of the night, they got their preparations and they dragged those one or two cannons they had left and a few cannonballs, a little gunpowder. They put them on these barges. You know, you've seen pictures of Washington standing in that boat. Well, that's not what it was. They were flat grain barges. But the men still had to get into the freezing water of the Delaware River, ice all over the place. They're soaking wet, dragging this stuff, getting loaded on these barges and crossing the Delaware in the middle of the night, freezing to death. When they got on the other side, they had to march up the embankment and into the town of the village of Trent. Just as the sun was coming up over the horizon, they marshaled the forces and fired that cannon down the middle of the street. And of course, all the Hessians and the few British that were there were asleep with hangovers. They'd been celebrating the night before, and it was New Year's. They'd been toasting their victory. The war was over. They were going to go home and get medals and extra money. And they'd been drinking. And boom, comes the cannonball down the center of the street, and they're jumping out of bed. Hessian general couldn't get his pants on, according to the story. He had to get his uniform on before he could take charge. You know how they did it in those days. Have to have the sword in the right place and everything. And by the time they got the men out in the street, the first soldiers that came out, the Hessians were so disorganized that they ran into the woods, into the orchard, into the woods. It was a rout. And the Revolutionary forces moved in, captured their cannons, turned it around, started firing them back. Now they had four or five cannons, and the whole thing was over in less than an hour. It was a miracle. And that was the turning point for the whole revolution. So I knew that miracles happen. So I thought, well, maybe another one will happen one of these days, and I want to be there in place when it happens. So that was pretty much my attitude. And now, I have to tell you, fortunately, that's no longer my position. I really now have great hope. And so my mission tonight is to tell you about that hope and to pass out air pumps. I think the first thing we need to know about how we are going to win this war is we have to get a little bit of an analysis going here. Right? Pretend like we're General Washington or some other general, and we're trying to lay out the plan. The first things we have to be clear about are those things which will not work. We can waste a lot of time doing things which cannot and will not work. So bear with me for a few moments while I tick off a list of 10 options. What can we do to win this war? And there are 10 things we have to choose from. And to make this clear, I'd like to present to you an analogy and put this in an analogy form. I think sometimes an analogy allows us to see the issues more clearly than the real life form because we get so wrapped up in all of the subtleties and so forth. So let's make it simple. And let's imagine that we are all on board a pleasure cruise, this magnificent ship, and we're cruising through the Caribbean, and we're having a wonderful time. Everything is so great. The food is fantastic. The drinks are flowing. The band is good. Everybody feels romantic. And the casino deck is going. And everybody's just having a wonderful time. Our misfortune is that we happen to be on deck at the upper level when a group of pirates take over the ship and we happen to see it. Now nobody else sees it. We just happen to be up there and there are just a few of us. And we saw that these guys came up there, they shot the captain, they tossed his body overboard, they took all the officers of the ship, took their uniforms off, put them on the bodies of the pirates, and they put the officers in the brig, and they took charge of the ship. And we saw it. Now, what are we going to do about it? Not only that, let's make it complete. We happen to listen to what their plans are. We know what their plans are. They're saying among themselves, okay, let's change the direction of this ship. We are now taking it to a prison island. We're going to dump all these passengers off where they're going to work the rest of their lives as slaves. They don't deserve what they've got. They've had too much affluence. They've not shared their wealth with all the poor people of the world. They're going to pay. We're going to put them in chains, and they're going to work on this slave island for the rest of their lives. And we hear that. And we know that that includes us. And now the question we throw out is, what are we going to do about it? Okay? The first thing is to do nothing. Now that's an option, isn't it? Do absolutely nothing. And I think a lot of people will probably choose that option. There are two motivations for doing nothing, in spite of the fact that we have this knowledge. One motivation is that we feel confident that somehow everything's going to turn out all right. I mean, after all, you know, this ship has been sailing for a long time, and the people of this ship have too much common sense. They wouldn't allow anything like this to happen. I remember in the 60s when I was doing my thing, I heard that a lot. People said, it could never happen in this country. American people have too much common sense. Yeah, we've had problems before, but, you know, we've always worked them out. I wouldn't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Do not. Well, you know, that used to have a certain ring of truth to it, because after all, we did see that everything was going on quite well. But, you know, it doesn't make sense anymore. Things have gone so far in our country and around the world that very few people are saying that anymore. In fact, some of those people that I remember used to say that to me, it couldn't happen here, they now ask me in kind of hushed tones, how much time do you think we have left? It's true. So that really isn't a good motivation anymore, although it may still be for some people. But there's another motivation that leads people to do nothing, and that is fear. They're afraid of reprisals. You know, those pirates are rough. They're not nice guys, and a guy could get hurt doing something. And they're afraid. Not only physically afraid of their person being thrown in jail, but they're afraid of their jobs. I had a lady just recently, so painful to me because I knew her well. And she was very interested in what we were doing, and then she got a little more informed, and she said, you know, I don't think I want to become involved with this. I said, why not? She said, well, you know, I might have an opportunity to get some good employment, and this might not look good on my resume. I might need some background checks, you know, a clearance with the government. And this might prevent me from getting a job. So she was afraid, you see. Fear would lead many people to do nothing. I don't think anybody in this room, or hope there aren't too many people in this room, who would let this fear keep them from doing something. Because when you think it through, ladies and gentlemen, no matter what the danger is now, it's going to get worse later. And if we do nothing, we'll wish to God someday that we had done something.
That's right. Yeah.
But not everybody will see it that way. For us, though, let's move on. That's not a solution. Even if that's our course of action, it's not a solution to the problem. So let's move to number two. Okay? Let's join the pirates. She said it. There are a lot of people who will do that. You know, I want to be on the winning side. You know, you people can do what you want to. You may go to that prison island, but at least I want to be one of the guards. You know? So they'll compromise. I don't think, you know, again, I'm not, okay, if there's anybody in this room that has that attitude, okay, I'm not talking to you anymore. That's not a solution. It's not a solution to our problem. Number three, though, is very popular. I run into this a lot. Well, we can't do anything about it, but at least, let's have fun and make money while we can. Let's plunge ourselves into work. Let's make a lot of money. Let's make wise investments. We might even take advantage of this. You know, we could produce newsletters, or we could sell investments that take advantage of the decline of prosperity. Let's make money. Let's go into business to show people how they can maneuver in this crisis. We'll sell them our services. We can make money. We can go to the casino deck and make a lot of money. Well, yes, actually you can do those things, but again, is this a solution? No, it's not a solution. Even if you do make a lot of money, they're going to take it from you. So it's not a solution. Let's cross that off the list. Number four, let's jump ship. This is not a nice ship to be on. Let's go someplace where we don't have this problem. Let's find a country someplace where they, you know, they're going to go. Let's find another ship. Well, in our analogy, let's be honest. All the other ships at sea have been taken over by similar branches of the same piracy. And all the ports. There's no place to go except a few flea-bitten islands where you wouldn't want to live very long. Couldn't live. It's not a solution. Number five, though, is popular. Let's hide. I think you both have thought about these things. You know, if we get rid of our Social Security card or whatever, put our zip codes in brackets. And they would find us. We'll get out of the system. I get a big picture, you know, when it comes to that, I hope it never does, but if it did, and those guys with the rifle butts come banging on your door at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they say, "Into the truck!" I could just see somebody say, "You can't do this to me! I don't have a Social Security card!" I have to say, I'm not trying to put anybody down that might have thought about these things or pursued these avenues. Because, you know, in some cases there's a lot of merit to these things. But let's face it, these are not solutions. They're not solutions. And that's what we're looking for, isn't it? You cannot hide. You cannot hide indefinitely. But now let's look at number six. This is very popular. Let's take them to court. Let's hire a good attorney. That's an oxymoron, isn't it? Let's hire an expensive attorney and we'll take these pirates to court and we'll show in the court that they are pirates and that they have violated all the rules of the high sea and that they cannot do this. Of course, in our analogy, we have to realize that we're on board the ship and the courts are completely in the hands of the pirates. So how long is that going to work? No, that won't work. Not a solution. Might have been at one time. It's not now. Number seven. Let's hold an election and vote these guys out. Surely we can talk, everybody. Let's assume that elections were even possible on board this ship, just to keep the analogy clean. Okay? Ship crews and captains don't have elections, but let's, in our analogy, put an election into the formula. So we're going to vote these guys out by spreading the word and telling everybody that these guys are pirates and they should be voted out of office. Well, the trouble is that most of the other passengers, remember, they don't know that this is true. And they'll look at us like we're crazy. Especially since their total source of information comes from the ship's newspaper. So, who are they going to listen to? We have a little problem with trying to vote these rascals out, especially if there are two political parties on board ship, and both of them are run by the pirates. And not only that, the pirates count the votes.
What's the name of this ship?
You know the name of this ship. It's the ship we're on. So, You know, that has a lot of appeal if we can just get the electric process going. Not that we shouldn't try, not that that isn't part of the total picture, but it's not the solution at the present time. So how about conducting a massive educational campaign and inform everybody that these are the pilots? Well, now that, we're getting close. That is really good, because without that, if we don't have support from the rest of the passengers on the ship, nothing that we're going to come up with is going to work. But that by itself isn't going to do the job, because you and I and the rest of the passengers don't have any power. The crew and the officers are the ones with the guns. We don't have the guns. We have no way to enforce our views on them. They have the power. And that's our topic tonight. Not just the power of guns, although that's the case in the analogy. They have the power. And I'm here to tell you that I don't care if 100% of the victims, potential victims, understood that they were pirates, it still wouldn't do any good as long as the pirates had total power over them. In every slave system that the world has ever seen, most of the victims, most of the slaves, were quite aware that they were slaves and that their masters were tyrants, but they could do nothing about it because they had not the power. So, should we write, number 9, write letters and send petitions to these guys, asking them to be nice? Let's get a petition going. Surely, when they see this petition with all of these signatures on it, they'll say, okay, we quit. These are all things, these first 9 things, that most of us who have been involved in this crusade for years have been doing over and over and over again in one form or another. And it hasn't worked. So that leaves only one thing left on our list. And it is to organize a counter-coup and recapture the ship. And that is what we must do. As insane as that sounds, as dangerous as that is, it is our only course if you're serious about solving the problem. And so what I want to talk to you now is about how we can recapture the ship. What do we need to do that? We're still in strategy mode here. What do we need? I think we need at least 6 things for us to do that. One, we have to recognize that there's not much that we can do alone. We need cooperative action. We need to organize. One person acting alone can accomplish a lot, as we know. But when 2 people join together on the same mission, they multiply their effectiveness. And it has a squaring effect. 2 people separately can accomplish the effect of 2. But when they work together, it's the effect of 4. 2 times 2 is 4. When 3 people work together, they can accomplish as much as 9. 4 working together can accomplish as much as 16, and so forth. I've seen this happen over and over again in organizational work. That's why we have football teams instead of just a bunch of football players. The multiplication effort, the effectiveness of people working together, is something we must put into our plan. We're not just going to run off as a bunch of individuals doing our thing independently. Although that's helpful. I'll take it. Thank you. But if we're going to get serious, we need to get organized and work together. The second thing that I think we need in the real world is to recognize that the pirates that we are facing are international in scope. They're not just in our country or in some other country. All over the world, we have the same team, pretty much. People with the same collectivist ideology that I talked about. And they work together. I think it's important for us to focus on our national issues and our national concerns first. But we must also be open to cooperation and joining forces with people of similar purpose in every country in the world. Now, this comes as a kind of a shock to many people who have been thinking that internationalism is a bad thing. Internationalism is not a bad thing. It's only a bad thing when it's applied as it is being applied today as a means to bring about a new world order of collectivism. Then it's a very bad thing. But if internationalism could be used to bring about nations united in peace based on the principles of freedom and individualism, it would be a wonderful thing. There's no reason that people from different countries cannot bond together if they have a common ideology and a common purpose, which is freedom. And we have to keep that into our plan. We must reach out to support and help from people all over the world. The third thing we need to understand is that we must be dedicated. We must be dedicated activists to this cause. We must be prepared, those of us who choose to do so, those of us who are going to try and capture control from the pirates and risk everything at it, we must be prepared to devote a major portion of our lives to this project. This is far, what I'm talking about is far more than just joining a political party or joining an organization and sending your dues in or going to lectures and listening to some speaker stand up and tell you how bad things are. Or going to a dinner banquet and, you know, they say eat, meet, and retreat. It's much more than just writing a letter to your congressman, much more than just circulating a petition now and then. The day of the armchair patriot is over. If we're going to solve this problem, we need dedicated warriors in this planet. The fourth thing we need is a training program to show our people who do come into this program, to show them the tactics and strategies of our collectivist opponents, because they're very clever and they use a lot of deceit. We have to show people what their tactics are and then show them how to ethically counter them. It doesn't just happen by instinct. You have to know what these people are up to and how they work. The fifth thing we need, and this is very important in my opinion, an organizational structure that cannot be subverted or destroyed by our opponents. Now, what do I mean by that? The typical organization that we all think of is pyramidal in form. There's the leadership at the top, with middle management down below, and then all the workers at the bottom, and they actually do the work. Almost all organizations that you can think of, everything from the military to a corporation to the Boy Scouts, everything, is pyramidal in form. And that works just fine, except on board this ship. Because with that structure, all our opponents need to do is knock off the head of the pyramid. And the organization is through. And how do they knock off the head of the organization? Lots of ways, you probably have noticed. First of all, they'll try and discredit it. And that's pretty easy to do since they control the media. They'll convince the world that this person is a bad person. They'll demonize the leadership of an organization. They'll have everybody convinced that he's a child molester, or he's a tax evader, or he's stolen money, or he's a drug dealer, or the list is endless. And when they come and haul the guy off, you know, the team comes with the masks and the rifles and everything, and they haul him off in handcuffs, and all the media is there to make sure that everybody sees it. And the people next door will say, you know, look at that on the television set and say, golly, he seemed like such a nice person. They'll buy into it. It's easy to destroy a person in the media if that's what your goal is. So that's one way of knocking off the leadership. Another way would be to buy them off. And that doesn't necessarily mean bribing them. I'm aware of numerous organizations where people have come under the pretense of being supporters and said, you know, we like what you're doing here a lot, and we'd like to support you financially. We have substantial financial means to do so. And we'd like to donate, how would you like $500,000? All we ask, of course, is that we be placed on your board of directors so we can see that our money is being wisely spent, but we sure like what you're doing. And this process goes on. The first thing you know, the board of directors is taken over and few years later, the organization is performing work for the other side. That's one way of knocking off the leadership. The other, of course, is to play rough. They have ways of arranging suicides and so forth. You know all that. How do we prevent ourselves from that, from getting involved in that? And the answer is that we do not form a pyramidal organization. What's the other type? It's holographic. Now, the hologram is a very amazing thing. I don't know how it works, but I try to understand it. I don't know how it works, but I know what it does. If you take a film with all these these circles inscribed on it, and you pass a polarized light through it, it looks as though there's an image, sort of in space, you know, three-dimensional image. If you cut that photographic plate or that holographic plate in half, the remaining half has the whole image. And you cut that in half, and that in half, and that in half. I don't care how small you go, each little piece of the hologram has the whole image in it. It's amazing. Now, it's smaller, but it's all there. This is the kind of an organization we need. That every person in the organization is a holographic unit. He has all of the information for the total movement contained in here, in here, and to some degree in the reference manuals and so forth. So that if everybody is wiped out, whether it's the leadership, the middle management, or every other unit in the organization is eliminated for some reason, as long as there is one left in the world, it has the capacity to regenerate the whole movement. So we need that. And then finally, the sixth thing we need most emphatically is a clear statement of positive principles. What are we for is just as important, if not more so, than what are we against. How many movements of history have we seen spring up where people have thrown off some tyranny at great cost of treasure and blood because they hated their tyrant? And then it turns out that they replaced it with something just as bad as it. Why? Because they never thought to ask, what does this guy that we're following, what does he believe in? All we're focused on is the thing we hate. We don't know what we want or what we stand for. That has to come to an end. We need a positive, clear statement of principles so that we rally behind our own banner and we know exactly where we're going at every step of this method. Now, we need to take stock of our resources, and especially our psychological and our emotional and intellectual and spiritual resources. And we need to ask ourselves, why have we been losing this battle for freedom so far? Why? Well, the answer was given to us indirectly by a Chinese general and philosopher who wrote in the year 500 B.C. His name was Sun Tzu. He's a very quotable guy. You can find his book called The Art of Warfare in almost every library. It's used in all the war colleges. They study it. And Sun Tzu said a lot of things that are worthy of note, but the one I want to quote to you tonight that pertains to our mission is this. He said, if a man knows himself and knows his opponent, he need not fear 100 battles. If he knows himself but not his opponent, for every victory he will suffer a defeat. And if he knows neither himself nor his opponent, he will suffer defeat in every battle. We have suffered defeat in every battle, have we not? And I suggest that the reason is that we do not know our opponent, and we surely do not know ourselves. So if we're going to charge into this battle, let's take a moment and see what we know about our opponent and then see what we know about ourselves. So hang on there. We're moving toward the master strategy, believe it or not. But the analysis is necessary. There are several things we know about our opponent. The first thing is that there is a difference between the totalitarians of today and days gone by. In the old days, so to speak, Totalitarians conquered by force of arms, by bullets, bayonets, and bombs. And they not only conquered that way, they kept the population in subjugation that way. That's not the way it's done anymore. In the last century, there's been a move toward the concept that people must have a voice in their own political destiny. And people expect to have elections, and they vote their leaders into office. And the implication is that if you vote somebody into office, then no matter what they do, it's okay, because you voted for them. See, it's back to that concept of the greater good for the greater number. If 51% of the people voted somebody in, even if he's a tyrant, well, what are you going to do about it? The greater good for the greater number. So the concept for the last century, increasingly so, has been to convince people that what is happening is their own choice, not something that is forced on them by bullets and bombs and bayonets. Even in that poor country, Iraq, they're trying to set up a system where they can convince those people that they haven't really been conquered. They're going to set up now a Republican or a Democratic form of government, and they're going to elect these people who have been selected by us, of course. So even in those countries, they've got to create the illusion that the population is participating in its own political destiny. It's the way it works today. And so the weapons today of conquest and subjugation are psychological, they're educational, and involves the flow of information, involves the media, the educational system, and the organs of propaganda, let's call it what it is. If you can convince people that this is right, then you don't have to subjugate them. They'll be meek. They will be passive. That's the first thing we need to know about how our opponent works, because that is his major tool. The second thing is that we've already touched on this, but we need to be clear on it, and that is that all modern totalitarian systems are merely variants of the same phenomenon called collectivism. We've got to get this out of our mind about we're not fighting communists, we're not fighting Nazis or fascists or socialists or liberals or conservatives, or whatever it is we think we're fighting, neoconservatives. We're fighting collectivists. And once you strip off that surface label, you find that they all are the same underneath, including this thing that's being sold to us today under the label of Americanism. You get that label off and look at the substance underneath, and it is no different than what we have fought against in previous wars. So we have to be clear that that is the nature of our enemy, and not any of these other labels. The third thing we have to know about our enemy is that he is fiercely dedicated to his mission. This is not an intellectual exercise with him. This is not a debate. They're not trying to win debates. They're trying to win power. Power is our topic. And they dedicate their lives to it. They live and breathe their mission. We mustn't forget that. They're involved in a total war in their mind. A war for world domination. And the fourth thing we must know about our opponent is that because they are at war, because these people think of themselves as being at war, they follow the ethics of war. What are the ethics of war? Anything goes. There is no ethics of war. The only evil in war is to lose it. That's the ethics of war. So this is their ethic, and they can justify absolutely anything as moral because they are at war. So quit expecting these guys to admit that they did something wrong, because they're not going to do that. Now, that brings me to a part that I want to digress on for just a moment to give you an insight to what that means. When I first became aware of these issues back in the 1960s, I became fascinated by the communist movement. And I studied all about the Nazis. I read Mein Kampf and all of that. And I said, what's the difference between these guys and the communists? And so I used to hang out down at the communist bookstore in Los Angeles on Larchmont Street. And I talked to the comrades down there, and they tried to recruit me. They thought they had a real live one here. And I didn't let on. I was just interested. And I bought a lot of their books and read most of them. And they invited me to their study groups, which were the large end of the funnel for the recruitment process. So I went to their study groups, so-called, and I participated in all of that, and I listened to their haranguing, and I participated, actually. I got up and repeated a few lines from Stalin and from Lenin and so forth. And I thought, oh, this guy's good. The reason I'm telling you that is because in that period of my evolution, I learned the difference between what they call a Marxist and a Marxist-Leninist. Now, that doesn't sound like much to most people. What is that all about? Very important. A Marxist is a person who's read the writings of Karl Marx, Das Kapital, Communist Manifesto, and they've read that and they believe all that stuff. It's very easy for an idealistic person to get wrapped up in that. The slogans are great, Workers of the world, unite. Throw off your chains. Get rid of the capitalist exploiters. And recapture means of the control of production. Let's unite against war and racism for peace and democracy. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. On and on and on. Well, all those slogans are good, aren't they? They sound good. So people become Marxists because they want to support the concepts that those slogans suggest. They are the Marxists. Not one of the countries that has ever fallen to communism has ever been taken by Marxists. It's true. Not one. They have all been taken by this other group, the Marxists/Leninists. So let's look at them. Now, they usually put a slash there. Sometimes they just refer to them as Leninists. But all of their official publications refer to them as Marxists/Leninists. Who are they? Well, they've read the writings of Marx, and they believe all that, but they've also read the writings of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, and they believe that. That's the difference. Now, Lenin was the creator of the Communist Party. He was the man that put organization into the movement. He was the man who basically said, comrades, it makes no difference what you think or what you believe or how smart you are or how good you are in debate. None of that makes any difference. It makes no difference how many books you've read. Only thing that matters, he said, is to come to power. Do whatever you must do. Say whatever you must say, even if it's a lie. To come to power. Because once you come to power, then you can afford the luxury of a debate. Because if you're in power, you just shoot all of those who disagree with you. He actually said things like that. He's a very quotable guy. One of his good lines is, promises are like pie crusts made to be broken. This is Leninism. And he knew what he was talking about. He said, for example, when you are trying to come to power in a country where there are strong nationalistic feelings, where there's a strong cultural root, we know that that's all hogwash, and we have to get rid of that and merge into internationalism. He said, but they don't know that. And if you stand up and tell them that they're wrong, they're not going to like you, and you won't come to power. The goal is to come to power. Therefore, tell them what they want to hear. Tell them that you are a strong nationalist. You become the most nationalistic person among them, and they will like you, and they will follow you. They will put you into power as their leader. And then you can get rid of their culture and their national identity. That's Leninism. He said, in many countries, there are people who don't like us communists. He said, so, you walk in and say, I'm a communist, here I am. He said, nonsense. No, you go tell them that you're a non-communist, or better yet, tell them you're an anti-communist. Become the best anti-communist there is, and they will follow you. And then you will come to power. And when you come to power, then you can destroy their movement. This is Lenin. The is the lesson of power. It makes no difference what you think or what you believe. If you're on the outside, you must get on the inside where the power is, he said. And then you can succeed. The fifth thing we must know, I should back up and just say that this is a classic strategy of Leninism, but it's not only Leninists who practice this. All collectivists practice this strategy. I mean, there's another group which we don't have time to discuss tonight called the Fabians. And they're collectivists just the same as the Leninists, and they fight each other a lot for dominance. Each one wants to be top dog in this pyramid of collectivist power at the UN, and so they oppose each other for relative position, but they are in agreement with each other as to the ultimate goal. And they use the same tactic, come to power. They all use it. So don't think for a minute that this is just Lenin. He just happens to be one of the most vocal and one of the most quotable people on this strategy. And finally, the fifth thing we need to know about our opponent is that all collectivists, regardless of their stripe, recognize the importance of controlling the power centers of society as the primary means of coming to power. And what does that mean? What are the power centers? The power centers, that's a sociological name given to groups and organizations in any society which involve mass membership. The organizations to which people belong. Humans have a herd instinct. We follow. We look for leaders instinctively. And wherever the leader takes us, we have an inclination to follow. Sort of like cattle in the field. Have you ever noticed? There's always one cow. It's always in the front. And when that cow starts to move toward the barn, all the rest of them look up and they try to get in line and they go. It's always the same cow. Now, if that cow dies or gets put into a different pasture, the other cows will wait around for a while. They don't see their leader. Another cow will step forward, and it will become the lead cow from that point forward. But all the cows must follow a leader. And humans, unfortunately, have that instinct. And so we all look for leaders, and we follow. And so we have all these organizations to which we belong, and we follow the leaders. I'm talking about political parties. I'm talking about church organizations. I'm talking about educational institutions, professional organizations, in all of these structures that we belong to. Have you ever noticed that often the leadership of these organizations have an agenda and a point of view that is totally at odds with the membership? I have seen that over and over again in earlier years. I couldn't understand why it is all the people at the top of this organization were all pushing for one world socialism, and yet you talk to the members, that wasn't what they wanted. And the answer is that all collectivists recognize that the only way that a few people can lead the many is by controlling the organizations to which they belong. Not individually. You don't control them one by one, but you capture control of the tops of the organizations in a society, and you can do that in several ways. If you have big money, you can buy them off. And if you have manpower, you can move into the membership and move up that way. And if you have both, of course, it makes it even easier. And so all of these collectivist groups recognize the importance of coming to power by controlling the power centers of society. And that's the mechanism that they all have used. And to give you an example, there was an obscure person by the name of Joseph Kornfeder who was a charter member of the Communist Party, USA. He joined in 1919. He went to Moscow and he trained there to become a Marxist-Leninist. And when he was through, they sent him back to the United States, and he did that. He plied his trade for a while, and then, like so many others, he gradually saw through the facade. He realized that the communists were using him to pursue goals which were not what they were talking about. And when he saw that, he, like so many others, dropped out of the party. And most people at that stage, they were young people, they're idealistic. And then when they saw the reality, they just dropped away, and they didn't want to talk about it. They were embarrassed by the experience. A few of them, like Kornfeder, felt he had an obligation to speak up on it and to warn people about what was going on. And so In 1955, many years later, Cornfetter gave a speech in San Francisco. And I'd like to read to you a few sentences from that speech, because this is the crux of how we're going to capture the ship. He said, "The true characteristics of the party are to be found not so much in its theories as in its methods of organization. Keep in mind, they are applying a new concept of warfare, the concept of conquering a country from within." How do you conquer a country from within? You conquer it by capturing the organizations that operate inside that country. A labor union, a farm organization, a newspaper guild, a teacher's association, a political club, a government agency, etc., are considered as power centers. The sum total of these organizations is the sum total of power. The party organizes inside of these organizations group by group. To fight them effectively, one has to do the same thing in reverse. Mere resolution passing cannot cope with that sort of an enemy. And is he ever right on that? See, we belong to organizations that pass resolutions, and we think that took care of it. We passed a resolution. And these people are working night and day to capture control of these power centers that go on and on and on. So let's review very briefly, what are the strengths of our collectivist opponents? Well, the main thing is, they're organized, they have a goal, they have an ideology, it's collectivism, they have a mechanism for planting it in the world, it's called the New World Order, to be centered in New York at the United Nations. They have a strategy, they have schools, they have training programs, they have communications, they have leadership. They are at war, and they have an army fighting that war. That's what we know about our opponent. And now, what do we know about ourselves? This is pathetic. By comparison, ladies and gentlemen, we are pathetic. Where's our plan? Where's our creed? Most of us are just wrapped up in our daily lives, trying to make a buck. We're trying to survive economically.